Welcome back to the Camp House Podcast and our limited series republishing some earlier episodes. Last week, I released one of my conversations with Christian Rushing called Living the Dream, where I had the privilege of interviewing Christian on his insatiable joy, hope, and love in the midst of a terminal diagnosis. And today, I'm excited to present another conversation with Christian, this one on urban design. If you have never studied the history of urban design in Chattanooga, this conversation is a good introduction. But more than that, it is a conversation that should still challenge us today as we continue to shape our city going forward. Christian talks about how our values shape our built environment, and those values can only be formed in community and dialogue with one another. So the only way we can create a place that is a reflection of us is if all of Chattanooga is engaged in the process. In other words, the shape of our public realm is an issue of justice.
And so now the question of designing public spaces based on a set of shared community values becomes somewhat difficult because now, again, we've got thousands of people. And so one of the challenges is figure out, okay, well, everyone who was kind of moved downtown, how do we want to grow together? What does downtown mean to all of us? How do we figure out a way to take all of these disparate points of view and come up with shared collective vision that we can then build on?
Christian Rushing is an urban designer, a person who sees the intimate connection between people and the places they inhabit. Christian has been involved in urban design in Chattanooga for more than 15 years, including time spent as part of the Downtown Planning and Design Studio. In this first episode, we'll explore more of his work and vision for good, vibrant urban design, as well as the effort behind creating the new Chattanooga Design Studio. This is the Camp House Podcast, and I am your host, Matt Busby. Christian, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So, you're an architect, correct?
I'm an urban designer.
Okay.
I've got a background in architecture and a background in city planning in my two degrees, but the profession is a little bit of a hybrid of both of those, maybe throw in some landscape architecture, and all of those things kind of put together help define the urban designer.
Well, talk to me about how you got into that field. As far as it sounds like you must have started out with architecture a little bit and then moved into some of these other areas. And then even before that, did you play with Legos, Lincoln Logs? Like, how are you drawn to this profession of architecture and then urban planning, urban design?
Sure. Well, I have always built things. I've always, you know, Legos and beyond anything that I could get my hands on, scrap material when I was a kid to build things, loved to do. And then I went to a magnet arts high school, and so the focus was on more or less graphic arts and sculpture. And when I left Montgomery to go to university in New Mexico, I wanted to go into advertising. So I wanted to be a graphic designer in an advertising firm. And so I went to visit one of my parents' friends who was in the advertising business, and apparently he was having a really rough day. So came in, told him what I wanted to do, and he said, no, you don't want to do that. Your clients don't appreciate your work, and they're always asking you to change your vision, and you work long hours, and you don't get paid. And so I said, well, that's for the birds. I'm going to go into architecture. And you find out when you go into architecture that the clients don't respect your vision, and you work too long, and you don't get paid. So it's very similar in that way. But I jump shipped and went to architecture school. And I kind of fell in love to begin with. It was drawing, it was graphics. But as my education progressed, there was something there that just wasn't quite right in my mind. Most of the projects we were working on are these theoretical projects that were more about the buildings and more about space than they were about people. Hmm. And they were almost always about a specific site. And they weren't really about the surrounding context so much. It was more about the object that you were going to design in space. And, of course, I can talk about that more articulately now than I could at the time.
Right.
I didn't really understand why it wasn't clicking for me.
But you had this implicit dissatisfaction for the way things were kind of being perceived and approached.
Correct. And so toward the end of my undergraduate career, I took a city planning class and kind of fell in love, because that was when we started talking about broader context, about how architecture fits into the public realm, you know, what the public realm even was. It was an introduction to me. And so then after I graduated from New Mexico, I moved back down south and went to Auburn and went to graduate school for community planning. And it was there that I was able to take the kind of design skills of architecture and marry them with the kind of contextual understanding of the city and the public realm. And so those two kind of disciplines together kind of comprise the urban designer.
So in so you graduated from University of New Mexico, went to Auburn, and then in what, approximately 1999 is when you moved to Chattanooga?
Yep, that was my first job out of graduate school. It was with the RPA, and Ann Coulter was the executive director at the time, and so she gave me my first shot here, and I've been here ever since.
What is the RPA?
Regional Planning Agency.
And is that, so is that different from, I know at one point you were part of Downtown Planning and Design Studio. Is it the same thing, or is that a different agency?
It was a different entity, but it was there was a connection to the RPA. So at the time, the design studio was partly funded by local foundations, partly funded by the University of Tennessee School of Architecture, partly funded by the mayor's office, partly funded by River City, and partly funded by the Regional Planning Agency. And they were doing, you know, so I came in, I'm working for the Regional Planning Agency, kind of processing zoning applications and subdivision regulations.
Exciting.
And very just, it bored me to tears in some ways. But I looked across the city and saw what the design studio was doing. And they were helping to kind of facilitate the community's vision for what downtown could be. And they were coming up with these fabulous visions and drawings and ideas. And so what I would do is finish most of my work at RPA kind of mid-morning, almost by lunchtime. And I'd go in the afternoon over to the design studio where I had a friend, and I would just help him work. So I just kind of would pitch in. And so I essentially worked at the design studio for about 6 months before Stroud, the executive director of the studio, before he realized that I wasn't actually a design studio employee. But once he did find out, we worked out a deal with the RPA, and I became a design studio employee full time.
Well, I guess staying with the design studio, why did that happen to begin with? So I have a feeling a lot of our listeners have never lived in Chattanooga during that design studio phase. So most of our listeners would have never heard of it, would have never known about it, unless they've kind of read the history of the last 30 years of the city. So can you explain a little bit about what is the design studio? What was the purpose? And then maybe why? What did you do in that capacity?
Sure. Well, the design studio originated around 1980, and it was a partnership between the Lyndhurst Foundation here in Chattanooga and the University of Tennessee School of Architecture. And Lyndhurst funded a position for a professor of third-year architecture students to come here to Chattanooga to have a remote studio. So students from Knoxville would come to Chattanooga and spend the year working on Chattanooga-based projects in the community. So they weren't kind of theoretical projects. And at the time, well, now that's a very common thing. Remote studios for universities is a common thing. At the time, we were kind of pushing the cutting edge on that, especially of work in the community. This is 1980-ish.
Okay.
And the person that they selected to run the studio is Stroud Watson, who had just to that point a phenomenal career that kind of spans continents, and had just finished working as the urban designer for Milton Keynes in England, which was a new town that they built from scratch. And they were adding 10,000 new residents per year to this town, and all the jobs and buildings and things that go along with adding 10,000 people a year. And so when he returned to the States, he was looking for a hands-on opportunity with students to be able to work on real community projects, but to do so in an academic way. Yeah. And so that was the start of the studio. And as the students' work became visible in the community and started to grow, the studio started to take on partners, the first of which was the city when Gene Roberts made Stroud his urban design consultant. And then the studio played a very significant role in the creation of Miller Plaza. Okay. And through that process, River City Company ended up being born. And so then the studio had developed a relationship with the River City Company. A few short years after that, when the aquarium came online, that relationship with River City played out more. And after the completion of the studio, that's when the connection with the regional planning agency occurred. And so the planning agency's downtown planner was housed within the design studio at that point. And so by the time I arrived in 99, the studio was kind of in full swing. It had all of those public and private partners. We had a staff of five or six. And so in my time there, we worked on refining plans for the South Side and Main Street. We worked on the downtown plan. And, of course, the big one, the big project we were involved with was the 21st Century Waterfront Plan. And so when the waterfront plan and the downtown plan ended in about 2005, that's when Stroud left the studio and I left shortly thereafter.
And then how long did the studio last after that, like once you two had left?
Well, I think, well, it depends on your definition of how long, of what the studio is. Because in some ways, Stroud was such a force of nature. It was almost, it's very tough to separate his personality from the studio itself. And so they were almost one in the same. So one could make the argument that once Stroud left the studio, that it kind of ceased to be. However, it continued on in name for some time. I'm not quite sure, but eventually as the regional planning agency kind of realigned its offices, they renamed it the Community Design Group, which exists today. So in some form, the legacy of the studio still lives on institutionally within the RPA.
Well, from what I understand, one of the big projects you were a part of was the, you just said it, the downtown plan, but there's also the city center plan that didn't come out too long ago. What's the relationship between those? What was your role in those two projects?
Sure. The downtown plan is a governmental document because we did that under the auspices of the Chattanooga Design Studio, or the Urban Design Studio. And so it was adopted by a city council. And so it is a kind of a public policy guide. When I left the planning agency in 2005, I joined forces with Jim Kennedy, Stroud, and Ann Coulter to form Kennedy, Coulter, Rushing, and Watson, which was a private planning and urban design firm. And then sometime after that, Stroud kind of semi-retired and Jim took a job as director of admissions at Baylor. And what Ann and I do is separate enough to where it didn't make sense for us to continue working together in that capacity. And so I started my own firm, Studio Christian Rushing. And so it was under that guise that I was hired by River City Company to pull together a team to do the Center City Plan. And that was done in 2012, I believe. And so that plan was a very focused plan, whereas the downtown plan, while still focused from, say, a county perspective, but downtown is a big place once you start to kind of break it down.
Right.
Center City being, you know, one of the components of the downtown.
Well, in the past, you've said a healthy region is dependent on a healthy urban core. And so can you talk about that a little bit more, especially in regards to the downtown plan and the city center plan? How does a healthy urban core help create a healthy region in general?
Sure. Well, it's, you know, it is partly a question of civic identity. Most, when you go to, when you find most healthy cities, they're headquarters of big business and employment and of kind of the expression of civic life are found in their downtown cores. And so when you have a downtown core that's open from 9 to 5 and then is shut and that doesn't have vibrant public spaces, that says something about the community. But when you have a place that is active and animated where people live, and you can tell that the streets and sidewalks and parks and plazas are loved and inhabited, where there is life after the businesses shut at 5, restaurants and events and nightlife, you know, all of those things feed into the civic identity. And when a city has a healthy core like that, it attracts, you know, other businesses, economic development, other people to live, to come and be a part of that. And of course, not everybody has a lifestyle where they want to live downtown, but they can still identify with downtown, come here for its amenities, and still live in the suburbs or hinterlands and still be part of that. And so, you know, from that perspective, a downtown that is a vibrant and active and healthy place really does make a positive impact on the region.
So in a series of blog posts you wrote for the Benwood Foundation called Community Voices, you praised the design and the vision for public spaces and the built environment that has brought us this far as a city. But in each post, you stressed that the work isn't done, that we shouldn't rest now. Buried in all of that is a desire and a dream for something more. Could you share that vision with us? What are you dreaming that Chattanooga will become? What's the next step?
Sure. Well, I'll start by saying that I have my own personal vision for what I think downtown should be. But what I think is more important is the community conversation about what we think downtown should be. And that really is kind of what's at the heart of what the design studio wants to do. It's to figure out these questions about what we want to be when we grow up. So the way I see it, the city, it's an awful lot like a forest. We have different elements of a forest that have different life cycles, and that go, some of them, their wheels spin faster than others. Their life cycle is very quick. Some of them, like big trees, live for hundreds of years. And so it is with the city. So we have buildings and parks and plazas, some of which there's high turnover, some of which will be there for 100 years. And so there is no real finished state for the city. It's constantly growing and evolving, just at a different pace. But how it grows and evolves is really a question of this kind of collective community vision for what we want to be. And so every time we take another step toward recycling the city, it's this collective view of how it needs to be done that kind of wins the day.
Well, I think another way you have talked about this in the past, and you're starting to go in this direction, I just want to push you that way a little bit further. How do our values shape what we create and design? How, or perhaps how could they?
Sure. You know, the one example I like to use to answer that question is the public realm. And so when you go to a city and the sidewalks are cracked and there are no street trees and the street furniture is mismatched and there's garbage around, and that tells you something about the city. And it tells you what the citizens value and don't value. But you can go to other communities where the sidewalk widths are generous, it's shaded, it's a pleasant place to be. The street furniture is comfortable and invites you to interact with it. Maybe cafes and restaurants are spilling out into the sidewalk. And that's a way that a community expresses its values, that they appreciate the fact that they can come together as a community in these shared civic spaces, places that belong to all of the citizens, and express their values. And so if generosity and hospitality and quality is something that the city, if that is what the city values, then it's going to show up in these public places. And so, you know, from my perspective, anytime that we work in the public realm, that's what we're going for when we want public input. We're not necessarily just asking, do you want a tree here or do you want a bench here? What we're really trying to get is what do you value when you think about your city? And then from there, you can talk about how you design to fit those values. But it's those overarching community values that really drive the form of the place.
Why is there sometimes a gap between those values and the way we think about ourselves and our values and the things we actually do create and design?
Well, it's, you know, it's an interesting question, but it's one that I think it's the question boils down to taking the time to think about it. And I guess I want to go in two different ways to answer this question. One is, you know, in the 1980s, when there was nobody downtown, it was kind of the ghost town. We've all heard the story. There's nobody living here. When people first started to move here, it was pretty easy to come up with a shared set of values because you have a very small group of people to deal with and who all have moved downtown for pretty much the same reason. And so from that perspective, in the early days of planning for public space improvements, it's kind of a piece of cake because there are not a lot of people playing in the sandbox. But if you fast forward to 2016 and you look at all of the new people who have moved to the South Side, all the people who have moved to ML King, all of the people who have moved to the riverfront, to the West Side and Cameron Harbor, look at all of these places. Now we've got thousands of people who have come from hundreds of different places in the region, from across the country, from various neighborhoods in town. And each of them bring with them a different aspiration, mm-hmm. a different expectation for what they think downtown should be. And so now the question of designing public spaces based on a set of shared community values becomes somewhat difficult because now, again, we've got thousands of people with varying levels of understanding of what urbanism is versus suburbanism. And they know what they like and what they dislike, but they don't, they may not have the vocabulary to talk about it in terms of urban design. And so one of the challenges is to figure out, okay, well, everyone who was kind of moved downtown, how do we want to grow together? What does downtown mean to all of us? How do we figure out a way to take all of these disparate points of view and come up with a more or less shared collective vision that we can then build on? That's a difficult question, but it's one that has to be kind of taken head on in everything that we do. Form-based code is a perfect example of it. You know, the other part of it is a very kind of nuts and bolts standpoint, where people are very concerned about public expenditure on any form of infrastructure. And so it comes down to a basic dollars and cents question. The thing about downtown is that because of the density of use, density of commerce, density, you know, residential density, economic development potential there, that investments in infrastructure here pay off more than they do in the suburbs. So if you take a half a mile of infrastructure and put it in the suburbs, you might serve three or four or five different users. If you've got a half a mile of infrastructure downtown, you're serving dozens, if not hundreds of users. So it's those types of trade-offs that we have to look at, is that downtown, you can't treat downtown the same way that we've treated the suburbs for the last 80 years. And so the way that we've written regulations and building codes and zoning laws, you know, are stacked to build suburbs. Mm-hmm. They don't, when they were written in the 50s, they weren't really concerned about living downtown. They were concerned about building suburbs. And so now that people are moving back downtown, you know, again, this is what the form-based code is all about. It's about creating a environment where doing the quote-unquote right thing from an urbanistic standpoint is possible downtown, whereas at one point it wasn't.
If our values and character are found in what we design, then what does the Madison Street project say about you? So talk about Madison Street for a minute and talk about the values and the vision that went behind that project in particular.
Okay. Well, the brief overview of the project is that I took that project on in kind of late 2007. My wife and I were looking for a home that was of modern design, that was green, and that was somewhat affordable. And of course, there was nothing in Chattanooga that kind of fit that bill. And at the same time, I was, in my mind, I kind of had this little splinter there that I spend my career working with developers trying to tell them what the right thing to do is to build. But I never took the risk of the developer. And so here I am kind of, you know, giving advice on something that I'd never done before. And so there was part of me that really wanted to walk the mile in the other guy's shoes. And a piece of property in the south side came up for RFP. And so I came up with a design and a proposal for that and won the RFP. And so here I am. I've never developed anything before in my life. I've got this opportunity to design and build these homes. And of course, this was the heyday of the bubble, and banks were shoveling money to anybody who had an idea and a heartbeat. And I had both.
So this was 2007.
This was 2007.
Okay. Okay.
And so from a design standpoint, what I wanted to do was pick out things that I saw in the neighborhood and interpret them in a way that was very much of our time in construction technique and material and in aesthetic. And so when you look around the south side in Jefferson Heights, we've got these offset porches. The homes that face the park are almost all two stories. They had double-story porches on them. But at the same time, we had this very industrial component. At the end of my street used to be a meatpacking plant. And then, you know, there were warehouses everywhere. And so all of these warehouses had these single-slope shed roofs. There was a lot of metal cladding on all of these different warehouses. And so the response that we got was we built these six buildings there, all of which had a shared roof, all of which, or pardon me, a shed roof, all of which had an inset porch, which was two stories high to kind of mimic the residential units in the neighborhood. And then we borrowed the idea of metal cladding for portions of the home from other industrial uses. We kind of put those together with my own kind of personal kind of design aesthetic, and we had them built. And they were completed in the fall of 2008, so just as the bubble burst. And, of course, I moved into one of them, so that one was off the market. But the rest, you know, we were kind of stuck with because banks were not lending, homeowners were not buying. But through some miracle of the pro forma, they managed to cash flow as rental units. And so put them on the market and rented them out. And then over the years, we just kind of opportunistically sold them off until now. All six of them are owned by neighbors, and everybody seems to love them and get along. And we managed to get out of it without losing our shirt. So that was my once and probably only foray into the development world. The other part of that is it kind of gives an insight into my proclivity for contextual design solutions. Virtually everything that I design is based on the context, the site context. So it's I'm always looking for what the next broader context is. And so it goes from the Saarinen's famous quote is, whenever you design something, always look at the next bigger context. So a chair in a room in a building on a street, and a street within a community. So I always kind of like to zoom out and then zoom back in. And so that's, to me, the Madison Street project is really kind of the embodiment of that type of thought for me.
You know, up to this point, we've talked a lot about the things you've been a part of or things that you've said in the past. But now we're kind of standing on the threshold of a new bold project in launching the Chattanooga Design Studio. And you started to mention a little bit about that project earlier. But can you talk a little bit more about this new venture? And is it a relaunch of the former Planning and Design Studio, or is this something totally new?
It's totally new. But having said that, you know, the saying that history might not repeat itself, but it certainly rhymes. We rhyme with the old design studio, and there are a lot of shared components. So, you know, I'm the executive director of the new Chattanooga Design Studio, but I was a former employee. Some of our board members were former employees. Some of our funders were former funders. So we certainly are built on this legacy, this tremendous legacy that Stroud and the former studio built. And we embody and embrace a lot of the principles and characteristics of the old studio. But as I've alluded to earlier, downtown is just a much different place now than it was 20 years ago.
Right, right.
And so there's a different set of needs. And the studio is equipped to operate in this kind of new setting for downtown.
Right. So go ahead and just give us the vision and the purpose of this new endeavor.
Sure. The mission of the studio is to educate, facilitate, and collaborate with the community to educate folks on the value of good urban design. And for each of our different constituencies, that's going to mean different things. But what we hope to do is bring value to the process for each of those constituents, is in value in the way that they define it. So a community will, a community group will value different things than, say, a developer. So a community is going to value quality of life, those types of issues. So we will show them how good urban design can improve their quality of life. A developer typically thinks of money, but let's say it's a developer who has kind of triple bottom line thinking. So he's concerned about the monetary aspect, the social aspect, and the environmental aspect. And so we would work with them to show them how good urban design can help them make money, can improve social conditions in the places that they're developing, and that it's can contribute to sustainably built environments.
Is that something you guys specifically measure for developers, is triple bottom line?
Not specifically. Every case that we deal with the developer will be something different. They'll have different needs, and we'll be able to bring value in different ways. But that's an example of what we would do. And then, of course, as we deal with elected officials, you know, they will value different things. And so if we can help show them that good urban design improves the tax base, or can help them figure out a problem case before it becomes a problem, before it's they're fighting it out in yeah. front of city council on a Tuesday night, if we can work with the developers and neighborhoods on these projects weeks before to come up with solutions that work for everybody, that's in everyone's best interest. And so that is kind of our outward facing work. What we'll also have is a work program where we will go out into the community and work on vision plans and projects. So we'll be involving the people who live here and people who are stakeholders. They may not live here, but maybe they own a business here or visit here, to help distill what a community vision is for a certain place or a certain project that we think needs attention. And so by doing that, we can put visions in front of the community, and sometimes they'll stick and sometimes they won't. But it's, I think it's part of our job is to help continually bring forth new ideas and new visions that are based on the collective desires of the community, and give a visual presence to those.
So I guess with that in mind, if there was one urban design project that you hope the city tackles and conquers over the next 10 years and that the Chattanooga Design Studio could play a part in, what would that be?
Oh, there's so many. That's a tough call. But what I will say is that one that is kind of front and center on my radar screen right now is the West Side. And, you know, when TDOT came in and clove downtown in two with this awful US 27 project that they did in the 50s, and that they've kind of come back to finish the job here in 2016. They've taken a certain population and kind of segregated it from the rest of downtown. And so if we look at the one side of downtown where businesses are thriving and homes are, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and kind of this the place where all the action is, that's one Chattanooga. And you go underneath the US 27 underpass and you've got a disadvantaged population there that's been cut off from all of the good things that have happened here over the last 20 to 30 years. And CHA is working now in College Hill Courts because they have some units there that they need to, that have kind of outlived their lifespan. And so what we would hope to do is be able to work with CHA and the city, and there are a number of other stakeholders and partners on the west side, but to come up with a way to find affordable housing for people who have lived there and whose families have lived there for generations and generations and generations, find ways to keep them there, find ways to get them a share of, or to engage them in the prosperity that's happening just across the highway there. And so finding a way to use urban design to improve people's quality of life without gentrifying the place, but to create these opportunities for everybody to share in the wealth that's going on downtown is one of the things that's on my heart, and one of the things that I think we can certainly get done within the next 10 years, and something that we want to actively be involved and engaged in.
At this point, I'm just curious if you actually have any plans in mind. Like, what are some solutions to making something like that happen?
Sure.
How do we bring them into this without gentrification, without displacing, you know, lower income residents of our city?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's certainly a tricky question, and it's one that a lot of cities face. And it really is a kind of a context-driven thing. But, you know, I kind of hate to get ahead of myself on talking about how you design things without having engaged the community first.
Sure, sure.
Right? But typically something like this involves phasing, so that we can bring some new units, find ways to bring new units online. Once a plan has kind of been fleshed out, how you go about implementing the plan is kind of the key aspect, so that it's probably done in phases where when we're moving out of buildings that have outlived their usefulness into new ones, that you find a way to get residents from one place to another with a minimum of disruption. But that's kind of the nuts and bolts of planning. But if we want to talk about like specific elements of a plan that might help that, one of the things that we kicked around in the early days that wasn't specifically about West Side, but it certainly has implications for it, is what we call the US 27 repair kit. And so to kind of back up a little bit on that, when TDOT came back to kind of finish the job with this new version of US 27, there's a large segment of the downtown population and stakeholders who weren't thrilled with the way that the state designed the road. And I was certainly one of those. But, you know, after a brief and spirited attempt to get TDOT to adjust some of the things in their design, it didn't work. And so as you can go out and see right now, they're kind of building what they wanted to build. And so we say, okay, well, if, you know, that is just reality. Yeah. TDOT's building what they wanted to build. But, you know, we've got five or six or seven things that we said were going to be the bad things that were going to happen if they did that. So then why don't we take a look at those five, six, or seven things and figure out what we can do to address those things as best we can until 50 years from now when we get another shot to work on TDOT.
Yeah.
So if we lost 25% of downtown tree canopy through this new 27 plan, okay, well, where do we find 25% tree canopy where we can put back somewhere else in downtown? If the connections between downtown and the west side are now even have been even lessened than they were before, how can we find new connections? What are the possibilities of finding ways to kind of overcome these gaps that we've got? And so there are, you know, economic development, so like you know, places where there would have been the potential to create development parcels that could be back on the tax rolls instead of just part of TDOT rights of way. You know, those are the types of things that we could look at. And so when we go into West Side, though, that's what we're going to be doing, is looking at ways to mitigate the impact of US 27 while making this West Side the best it can be and more integrated with the rest of downtown. I think the ultimate shot that we would be looking at is in those 50 or 60 years from now, when we get another shot at TDOT or at another shot at US 27, what does a good version of that road look like? And so if we can come up with an idea for that and then come up with the design that supports that, then maybe that's a long-term vision. But again, this is something that we would want to work out with as many partners as we can.
Sure.
Bring as many people to the table as we can to talk about these things, because that's the future of the community.
Right.
And it belongs, that discussion belongs in a public venue, not with two or three folks up in Nashville.
So reflecting on your career up to this point, what's the one thing you're most proud of?
Well, there are two things right now that I'm most proud of. One, from a purely selfish design standpoint, I'm really proud of the Madison Street project, just because it was something that I did nuts to bolts. I was the developer for it. I designed it. I live in it. And so it went from bare ground to something that I came up and worked with my wife and children to design the home for us, went out, did the construction drawings myself, went out, got the money to do it, built it, hired the contractor, ran that part of the process as well. And then eventually, I became a property manager for a while, unwillingly, and then sold it. And so there is that. The other thing that I'm really proud of, and I mean, I guess this one is somewhat selfish too. I've had a client, a foundation in Iowa that I've been working with since, oh good Lord, we're probably, I'm working on 6 years out there now. In this spring, during one of my visits out there, they surprised me with Christian Rushing Day, and they also unveiled the fact that they had renamed one of the downtown streets for me. So there's now a street called Rushing Way out in Iowa. And
is the speed limit pretty fast on that
street?
It sounds
slow,
like it'd be pretty fast.
And it is, I think it's worth noting that the city's last strip club is located on that street as well. So that kind of tells you a little bit about the quality of the street that they named, that I got named after me. No, but the fact that I was able to establish with my clients just this great relationship where we've done excellent work. And beyond that, we just kind of had a great human connection between me and my friends in Iowa. That's something that means an awful lot to me. And it makes me kind of swell with pride, because it goes beyond doing a good job.
What is that town in Iowa? What's the name of that town?
Ottumwa. It is the fictitious home of Radar O'Reilly. Radar O'Reilly being the one who is fictitious. Ottumwa is a very real place.
All right, so one last thing. I just mentioned blogging, and people who know you know that you're a pretty avid blogger. And a few years ago, you wrote a pretty popular piece. And based on that, I just want to ask you, what do you have against Applebee's and Chili's and Buffalo Wild Wings?
Well, on one level, I don't have anything against them. All of them were businesses that started as small businesses and did a good enough job at what they do. They grew into large businesses, and they employ people and they feed people. And some people think that the food is good, and I think that's awesome. And so from that standpoint, I don't have anything against them. When I write about those places, for downtown, though, I look at it through a slightly different lens, because what makes cities in general and downtowns in specific special is authenticity. And so when you have a downtown that has a lot of homegrown businesses, small mom and pop businesses, or big mom and pop businesses, that is something that is unique and authentic. And the people who live there and the people who visit there understand these things, whether they understand it consciously or not. And so anything that we can do to maintain authenticity of downtown is a good thing. The second part is it kind of hits, it goes to the contextual design element that I talked about that I'm so big on. In those cases, what those businesses have done is kind of taken their suburban stereotype building and just kind of plopped it down on an urban site. You know, the argument on their standpoint is, well, you know, we do this everywhere. And so that's because part of our branding is that people see that building and they know who we are. And the drawings are already done. And it's just easy for them, right? But what they all do is kind of disrespect the fabric of downtown. So downtown, one of the things that's in the DNA of downtown is density. And so if you take density out of downtown, you make it an urban place less than urban, which is suburban. So you get enough of these things that chip away at our density and chip away at our urbanity, you actually lose the character of downtown.
Yeah.
And so what we find is that in a lot of communities, in the communities that care, when Applebee's or Buffalo Wild Wings come to town and say, we want to put this stereotype store in here, they say, well, first, thank you so much for coming to our community. We think that it's fantastic that you want to invest here, and that's great. However, in our downtown, the buildings behave in a certain way. So if you would like to build this here, this is the form that we would like the building to take if you can. And in the past, we haven't had the ability to really have those conversations that have any teeth in them. You know, you can talk to them and try to persuade them that this is the right thing to do, but there was nothing in code or regulation that would require them to do anything. And fortunately, that's now changed. So with the form-based code now, we have established or the city has established this kind of minimum level of urbanity that when a chain restaurant or
anybody
comes mm-hmm. in, that they start off in a default urban position. And then if they want to do something else, they got to jump through the hoops.
Yeah, so nobody can impose their own vision on downtown. You have to conform your vision to what the community has said they want in a downtown.
Absolutely.
That's great.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time, Christian.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for having me.
This is a blast.
Amen.
Thanks for listening to this conversation about urban design in Chattanooga with Christian Rushing. If you'd like to learn more, there are three websites that you can check out. One being Christian's own personal blog at christianrushing.blogspot.com. You can also check out his personal studio page at christianrushing.com or the Chattanooga Design Studio at chattanoogastudio.com. And as always, if you've enjoyed this conversation, then please subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever it is you find your podcasts. And if you want to share this episode or maybe one of the previous episodes, check out our website at thecamphouse.com/podcast.